I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
There are some confusing but perhaps encouraging signals coming out of the White House and the Israeli cabinet today, indicating that the so-called roadmap to Mideast peace may be back on track. This morning, the Bush administration said the U.S. agrees with Israel that there are serious reasons for concern over the roadmap. But today, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said Israel is prepared to accept the U.S. plan. Well, joining us to parse all of this from Jerusalem is John Anderson. He's correspondent for The Washington Post. John, adding to the confusion, yesterday Hamas leaders met with a Palestinian prime minister who asked them to stop violence. Today, Hamas is claiming credit for a pipe bomb in the Gaza Strip. So what's going on here?
Well, Hamas just does not accept the authority of the new Palestinian prime minister, Mahmoud Abbas. And they believe that they have the right and they're going to continue with their violent resistance to Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Mm-hmm. They want Israel. They said that they were willing to agree to a ceasefire, but they want Israel to stop the targeted assassination of Hamas leaders. And there's really no indication at this point that Israel is willing to do that.
Well, but the roadmap requires that they do. Let's go back to the statements. The Bush administration saying that they agree with Israel that there are serious reasons for concern over the roadmap, and that statement was co-signed by Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell. But we also have Powell in Paris today saying we're not planning on making any changes to the roadmap. Does it come down to the definition of the word concern?
What it comes down to is how this roadmap is going to be implemented. The roadmap calls for instance, the Palestinians and the Israelis to make simultaneous parallel steps, confidence-building steps. We'll do one thing, you do another. So the question becomes, when push comes to shove, is Israel going to implement its steps of the roadmap, or is it going to demand that the Palestinians first crack down on terror? It seems that the United States has agreed with Israel that it really does not need to take these steps in tandem with the Palestinians.
So is that like a flag for the a go-ahead, a green flag for Israel to issue its statement that it's prepared to accept the plan, knowing that it might be changed?
I think that's basically what's going on, exactly, that they're going to vote. The Israeli cabinet is going to vote on the roadmap, but with sort of an understanding that when push comes to shove, they may not have to implement it because the U.S., quote, understands their dilemma or understands their concerns.
What do you think happens next?
Boy, that's a tough one. There's no doubt that the Palestinians are going to have to do something to try and rein in terror. There's no way this roadmap or any peace plan is going to get off the ground if you have five suicide bombings in 2 days. So they're going to have to do something. And at the same time, Israel is going to, I think, in order to keep the Palestinians on board, they're going to have to make some sort of concession to humanitarian gestures or some kind of gestures in order to keep the Palestinians at the table and in the game.
Meanwhile, very briefly, John, we hear that there are Palestinians speaking out against Hamas. There are Israelis offering to pay settlers to move back to Israel. Are these just tiny voices at this point?
No, I think a lot of people are speaking out against Hamas, and yeah, huge numbers of Israelis would like the settlements to be evacuated. Those are significant portions of the populations.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that as well. John, thank you. Thank you, John.
Okay, thanks, Robin.
Thank you. John Anderson is correspondent for The Washington Post. He was speaking to us from Jerusalem.
We may never know for sure how many people died in the recent war in Iraq. The U.S. government does not make an official estimate for numbers of either civilians or opposing forces killed, but Peter Ford of the Christian Science Monitor has been speaking with independent researchers who are trying to assess the extent of civilian deaths in Iraq. He says the evidence points to 5,000 to 10,000 Iraqi civilians killed, far more than in any U.S. conflict since Vietnam. Peter Ford now joins us on his satellite phone from the highway near Babylon, about 60 miles south of Baghdad. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
Peter, 5,000 to 10,000 civilian dead in Iraq. Where do the numbers come from?
They're doing it in different ways. Most of them are starting in hospitals, taking hospital records to see who died in hospital, who was brought into hospital already dead. But they're also going to mosques, they're going to morgues, are going to ordinary homes and asking if they know where graves are. Because in a number of cases, and it's impossible yet to tell how many, people are still just finding these graves and digging them up.
Is there any sense yet how a majority of these civilians would have been killed?
Obviously, two main ways, one from the air and the other from the ground. The particularly worrying aspect of the air war was cluster bombs. Cluster bombs would set off thousands of little bomblets that explode shards of metal over an area about the size of a football field are particularly lethal. They're designed against concentrations of men and armor in open areas. They do appear to have been used in civilian areas. I myself have found unexploded cluster bomblets in suburbs of Baghdad. Yeah, we're rolling now because there's quite a lot of gunfire quite close to us, so we're moving.
Peter, did you say there was gunfire?
Yeah, it's gunfire, but a couple of hundred yards away, but it's hard to tell who's shooting at what.
Not clear who's shooting at what. Is this...
So we just...
Peter, what is your sense of what's happening there? You're talking about gunfire?
Yeah, it's a couple of hundred yards away from some palm groves and farmland, just by the side of the highway down which I was stopped. It doesn't appear to be directed at us, but I thought it was probably wiser to drive away from the area.
How ordinary is it to hear gunfire? You're not in Baghdad.
No, in Baghdad, it's getting less common. It's still a nightly occurrence, and gunshot wounds are a regular occurrence at most of the hospitals in the city. I don't frankly know how often one hears gunshots out this far out of town. There were some civilians running that I saw, so they obviously didn't regard it as completely normal.
Peter, the civilian administrator there, Peter Bremer, is beginning a program of disarming Iraqis. How do you think that will go?
Well, I think the vast majority of Iraqis will welcome it if what he's talking about is disarming people who are found with weapons on the street. If he were to try to disarm every Iraqi by going into their houses and taking their guns away from them, I think he would generate a great deal of resentment. Because given the current climate of insecurity, even though it is getting better than it was before, most Iraqis feel that they are safer with a weapon in their house to defend themselves against anybody who might attack them.
Peter, why is the climate of insecurity getting somewhat better?
Well, it's getting a little better because in Baghdad, which is where it has been worst, because there are more American soldiers dealing with it more aggressively. I mean, for weeks, American soldiers just stood by and watched looting. Now there are aggressive night patrols, there are checkpoints on the roads. Generally, there is a greater and more aggressive American military presence on the streets of Baghdad, and most Baghdadis welcome it.
What are the emotions that you're observing toward the American soldiers at this point?
The general emotion towards the American occupation authorities is thank you very much for having got rid of Saddam Hussein. Now can we have our electricity, please? There is a good deal of puzzlement about why basic services such as electricity and water, garbage collection and so on, are so scarce in Baghdad.
Peter Ford, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Sorry about the interruption.
Well, sorry about the interruption for you, too. Peter Ford is a staff writer with the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from north of Babylon in Iraq.
Well, in Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai's government is waiting to see how that country's powerful regional warlords will respond after agreeing this week to stop their interference in political affairs and begin sending much-needed revenue to the capital. A year and a half after U.S. turned over Kabul's reins to President Karzai, the country is near collapse. Afghans question whether the Bush administration is providing adequate financing for reconstruction, and also how much further security will deteriorate. Warlords are already imposing Taliban-like restrictions on Afghani citizens. Well, joining us to discuss the situation in Afghanistan is New York Times reporter Carlotta Gall, who joins us from Kabul. Hello, Carlotta.
Hello.
Well, goodwill towards Americans had to be further eroded this week when Marines guarding the U.S. embassy shot and killed three Afghan soldiers. The U.S. troops thought mistakenly they were being fired on.
That's right. And I think it's upset the Afghan soldiers enormously because they said it was a completely unprovoked attack. The interior minister came out the following day saying that after the preliminary investigation, the Afghans didn't fire at all.
Well, and this comes on top of frustration with the reconstruction efforts. Just how bad is it? What are the Afghanis talking about?
I think the real feeling, whenever you ask anyone about reconstruction, they just say, well, nothing's been done. I think they feel that the government and the foreign donors haven't done anything really big that they can see. The roads are just as bad as they are, and they have to be among the most terrible in the world. There are a lot of bridges that were blown during the war, and they're still down on the main roads. And so that, I think that's incredibly frustrating to a lot of Afghans who heard about the donors' meetings and how billions of dollars were being pledged for Afghanistan, and they really don't feel they've seen it. And they're starting to wonder if it's all gone into the pockets of people or if it was just pledges that were never fulfilled. So there's enormous disappointment and frustration, I think, here.
Well, and add to that the fact that the country itself isn't collecting the revenues from within the country because of the warlords we mentioned, or the regional governors, as some of them are called. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that is a very serious problem for the government, and it's been waiting and handling these warlords quite carefully for a year and a half. And I think the government is finally realizing that they cannot survive like this, because you have these regional powerful leaders who collect customs at their borders and they hold on to the money. But of course, there are a lot of provinces that don't have a border and don't have revenues who are really feeling left out because they're getting no money.
It's a war that's far from over.
Certainly the Taliban are still out there and unrepentant and claiming they deserve to be in power. And then there's, you know, inevitably so many guns and weapons and so many jobless that you're always going to get a lot of violence in every district. Mm-hmm. And then you've got powerful provincial leaders who don't really listen to the central government. So you've got a sort of, you know, it's a more polite war, but it's a battle for power and it's a battle for funds and so on. So, yes, it's got a long way to go still.
Carlotta, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Carlotta Gall, New York Times reporter, spoke to us from Kabul.
Well, just ahead, we turn from the international scene to your garden and the matter of mulch.
And later in the program, actor Philip Seymour Hoffman takes a gamble in owning Mahoney.
More coming up here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Perennial Designs of Needham, creating custom silk and dried floral arrangements to celebrate every day, also offering a selection of garden-inspired gifts and accessories, and by Johnson Drugs in Waltham, a health and wellness pharmacy, offering an integration of mainstream and complementary medicine with an extensive selection of nutritional supplements, herbal medicines, and homeopathic remedies. Right now, 54 degrees, overcast and raw in Boston. It's going to stay that way through the entire weekend. This is WBUR.
Something new is coming to WBUR this June. It's the first annual WBUR online auction, and you can help make it a success. If you have an item or service you would like to donate to the auction, please let us know. We'll thank you by providing your company or organization with exposure on the air and on our website. To make a donation, call 800-909-9287 or log on to WBUR.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Mulching. Yuck. But gardeners everywhere insist it must be done to keep your garden healthy, happy, and growing. So here to take away the intimidating aspect of mulching is Mike McGrath, host of the weekly public radio show, You Bet Your Garden. He joins us on the line from WHYY in Philadelphia, and welcome, Mike.
Well, thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here, but what's with the yuck, man?
Mulching. It's just got that sound about it.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. I wonder if you don't misunderstand what mulch is, and if you did, it wouldn't be your fault. It would be the fault of the farmers who take all their used bedding from their animals, all the manure, all the spent crops, and pile it up in a huge pile. And you know what they call that pile?
No, what do they call that pile?
The mulch pile.
The mulch pile. Well, you know.
But it's not. It's a compost pile. See, you got compost.
Much more civilized sounding word, compost.
You like compost.
Yeah.
Right.
What is mulching?
Mulch is any substance you lay down on top of the soil to prevent weeds. And would you rather lay down mulch, Bill, or would you rather get out there and pull weeds?
Oh, I'll put down the mulch any day.
And it also conserves soil moisture. And under the right kinds of mulch, microorganisms, great living things that benefit your garden plants thrive, especially shredded leaves. But the problem, and the one thing I wanted to talk to you guys about to help your listeners be more aware, is that the most common form of landscape mulch can kill your plants and harm your home.
Oh, you mean the stuff you would buy in a garden store or?
Or have dropped off at your house by the truckload. And I'm talking about wood chip mulch.
Not a good idea.
Wood mulches are bad for several reasons. First, wood wants to compost down and become soil. And wood is almost pure carbon. So it's looking for nitrogen to react with. And nitrogen is plant food. So if you put it down on top of the soil around plants, it'll suck the plant food out of the soil.
Huh.
Now, it'll feed the plants 3 or 4 years later when it breaks down, but tell that to the poor plants out there starving to death right now. Wood mulch can make real serious problems up against the side of a house. Subterranean termites exist throughout the entire country, and they won't ever come above ground. So can you imagine, Bill, you lay down a wood chip mulch or a shredded bark mulch right up to the side of your house, so you're laying out food for them. You're giving them protective cover, and you're kind of like putting up a neon sign that says, please, come eat my siding, come eat my framing, you know.
Welcome to all termites.
I didn't even get to the worst problem.
Well,
this is the cool one. This is the fungal problem. Wood chip and shredded bark mulches actually breed a fungus called shotgun fungus or artillery fungus. And remember what eye cups look like, Bill? People would soak their eyes with, like, minute boric acid solutions. They'd have this cup they'd put over their eyes. You ever see one of those?
Yeah, I think so.
That's what the fungus looks like. And all of a sudden, it looks like there's a little eye cups popping up out of your mulch.
Ooh.
And inside the eye cups are like these little black golf balls. Well, those black golf balls shoot what are called fruiting spores 30 to 50 feet towards light-colored objects.
Phew.
And it looks like little tar stains, and you literally cannot get them off the house without replacing the siding.
They shoot out.
Oh, yeah, 30 to 50 feet. They found them up on the second floor of houses. You know, nature is amazing. You know, that's the whole thing behind Spider-Man, the proportionate strength of a spider. You know,
it's a spider
these little
mulch.
Guys.
Yeah,
exactly. These little guys, what they make up for, what they lack in size, they make up for in power.
So we've heard how not to mulch. How does Mike McGrath mulch?
Mike McGrath saves all his fall leaves. When they come down, I shred them up with a leaf blower. And they make the perfect mulch. They keep weeds down. They keep moisture in the soil. And earthworms love them. So after like half a season, you look under the mulch, the ground is teeming with earthworms.
Mike, do you recommend only organic mulching?
No. Actually, people in your region, Bill, in the colder areas of our country, they rely on black plastic mulch to keep the soil warm if they want to grow long season crops and heat-loving crops like melons, especially the real beautiful heirloom melons, things like Moon and Stars watermelon or Queen Anne's pocket melon. You really need black plastic mulch to do that. And about half in the northern half of the country, and believe it or not, there are, I believe it's a yellow plastic mulch that confuses aphids and other pests. They go nuts. They can't stand to be in the area, so they'll stay off the plants.
Huh. Now, what about for listeners to our program in lovely, warm places like Arizona? How should they mulch? Do they need to mulch?
Well, sure, because can you imagine? I mean, it's 160 degrees today, Bill, but it's dry heat, so we don't mind. Well, maybe they don't mind, but the ground and the plants are constantly being dehydrated. you know, as that air tries to get to stasis, as it tries to climb all the way up to like 20% humidity. So it's very important to have a nice layer of mulch on top of the soil to keep any moisture that you happen to find in the soil down in it. But never, no matter what your situation, you never want more than an inch or two of mulch. And you never want to build these volcanoes, these tributes to Pele that you see landscapers do to trees. Hmm. That's because they want to sell you a new tree next year. That's going to rot the base of the tree. It's going to give a hiding place to insects and vermin and disease to get started and attack the trunk. And once you put down more than 3 or 4 inches of mulch, you're almost guaranteed that you're going to kill any plant because it compresses the soil. It starves the roots for air.
So at the end of the day, any gardener worth his or her salt should mulch.
Yes, actually, at the beginning of the day, keep that nice moisture in the soil. If people don't have any fall leaves and they don't use herbicides on their lawn, the absolute best mulch that was ever tested is dried grass clippings. Just go over your lawn, either collect the clippings and then spread them out to dry, or let them lay on the lawn just for 24 hours. They'll change color remarkably. Obviously, you need to do this during a dry spell. And then you mulch your plants with it. It's the most attractive mulch. Back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, my photography editor used to carry it around in a bag because he liked to mulch plants with it that he was shooting. He said it was the most attractive mulch that he had seen. And it kept weeds down better than black plastic in studies at the university, at the Rodale Institute Research Center in Pennsylvania.
Mike McGrath, we want to thank you for telling us more than maybe we ever knew before about mulch.
Bill, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Next time on Here Now, hundreds of pictures taken on a single day paint the picture of a day in the life of the United States Armed Forces.
And also the story of jazz legend Chet Baker. That's next week.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Design Center. Find furniture, fabrics, antiques, kitchens, bath, and home electronics featured in 75 showrooms on South Boston's waterfront, bostondesign.com. By NetNumina, a solutions integration firm working with financial services and pharmaceutical companies to meet business goals through technology in New York and Boston and at NetNumina.com. And by Roberto Mighty Productions, producers of This Amazing House, where design experts critique distinctive homes, airing this Monday night on WCVB-TV Channel 5 at 7:30. Meet Here and Now host Bill Delaney. Learn more about our next Citizens of the World Tour of Ireland at a free reception this Tuesday, May 27th. To reserve your space, call 800-909-9287. It's 54 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
NPR's Silvia Poggioli.
The admission of 8 former communist countries is a very powerful symbol of Europe's reunification. So the EU is going to need some very serious internal reform, and everybody agrees that's not going to be very easy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Don't miss a chance to meet the incomparable Silvia Poggioli at an exclusive brunch I'll be hosting on Sunday, June 1st. Seating is limited. For tickets to benefit WBUR, call 1-800-909-9287.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, our editorial roundtable considers whether the $350 billion tax cut passed by the House and Senate will really pass muster with most Americans.
And Philip Seymour Hoffman stars as a compulsive gambler in the new film Owning Mahoney.
I thought we had a relationship here.
We have a relationship, and that is why I'm shutting you down.
For a few grand?
It's not a few grand, Dan. It's $10,300.
So what am I supposed to do? Go to the racetrack and watch?
A review and more coming up Here and Now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. A divided Senate passed President Bush's trimmed-down tax cut bill today, 51-50, with Vice President Dick Cheney casting the tie-breaking vote. The $330 billion package will cut taxes for families, investors, and businesses. The measure is much smaller than the president wanted, but supporters say it will stimulate the economy. Iowa Republican Senator Charles Grassley says the cuts will help families.
Voting for this measure is a vote to put around an extra $1,000 into the pockets of a family of four, assuming two children, and it will do that compared to current law of about $600 per child.
But Democrats, such as Senator Kent Conrad of North Dakota, say the tax cuts will benefit mostly the wealthy and will hurt the economy.
This is a scandal in the making. We're going to read that there are perverse results as a result of this tax policy.
The tax cut bill now goes to the president, who's expected to quickly sign it into law. The Mideast peace plan is getting some support in Israel today. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon says he's willing to accept the roadmap to peace, which was put together by the U.S. and others. Sharon says he'll present the plan to his cabinet for approval. In a statement, Sharon says he's ready to accept the steps prescribed in the plan, which calls for an eventual Palestinian state. It looks like the strained relationship between the U.S. and France is on the mend. After meeting with French Foreign Minister today, Secretary of State Colin Powell says the two countries have decided to put their disagreements over Iraq behind them. Powell says France's vote to lift U.N. sanctions against Iraq is a step in the right direction. 83-year-old Edmund Hillary of New Zealand arrived in Nepal today to take part in celebrations commemorating the 50th anniversary of his climb up Mount Everest. Hillary and a Sherpa guide reached the top of the 29,000-foot mountain on May 29, 1953. Since Hillary's climb, 1,200 men and women have reached the top of Mount Everest. Annika Sorenstam is heading into the second day of play at the Colonial Golf Tournament. Sorenstam stands at one over par after yesterday's historic first round, which marked the first time in 58 years a female golfer had played in a PGA Tour event. Sorenstam is currently tied for 73rd and needs to finish in the top 70 in order to make the cut. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Chobe Hoy Associates, previous winner of the TAB's Reader's Choice Award for four consecutive years, offering real estate consultation for sales or rentals, 617-739-0067. By Colonial Nissan, Metro Boston's new Nissan dealer, featuring the new Muranos, Maximas, and 350s, located 5 minutes from Boston on Mystic Avenue in Medford. And by the Elephant Walk Restaurant in Boston, newly renovated and with a new spring menu, serving dinner nightly and lunch Monday through Friday, 900 Beacon Street and online at elephantwalk.com. In the forecast, a great weekend for staying indoors. All the way through the Memorial Day weekend, cloudy, rain likely, especially tomorrow. The best chance for a dry day appears to be Sunday, 54 right now in Boston. And in sports, weather permitting, the Sox will open a three-game stand against the Cleveland Indians at Fenway.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, the Senate this morning approved a $350 billion package, as the House did yesterday, lowering Americans' taxes. Whether most Americans are worried about lowering their taxes or not. An NBC Wall Street Journal poll this week found that 68% of Americans believe the president's approach to the economy relies too heavily on tax cuts. 55% would rather have the federal government spend money to help employers pay for employees' health coverage. So how does this week's tax cut cut it with Americans? We're going to check in two regions. Joining us on the line are members of our editorial roundtable. Alicia Blaisdell Bannon is managing editor of the Cape Cod Times in Hyannis, Massachusetts. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Bill.
And Nolan Finley is editorial page editor of the Detroit News in Michigan. Nolan joins us from Berksville, Kentucky, where he's already vacationing. Well done, Nolan.
Thank you. Hi, Bill.
Thank you both for joining us. Nolan and Alicia, let me read you something just for a moment from the Washington Post this week, an op-ed by billionaire financier Warren Buffett. He said the dividend tax cut included in the new package could mean a $310 million windfall for him and that he could get his eventual tax rate down to 3%. His receptionist, on the other hand, he calculated, could wind up paying 30% of her income in taxes, meaning she'd pay 10 times more of her money in taxes than the billionaire. What's the sense, Nolan, of the tax cut in Detroit? Is there a sense that it's fair?
Well, I hope that Mr. Buffett takes the billions he'll get in a windfall and invests it in the economy, creating jobs, and I hope his receptionist does the same. Hopefully what the impact of this tax cut will be a real resurgence in the stock market, which should make all of us feel wealthier, should restore our 401k plans and our mutual funds and our other investments, and hopefully bring back some confidence that this economy is going to pull out.
Well, what's your sense, Nolan, whether that's going to happen, and what's the sense of the average person in Detroit, as much as you can pick up on it?
I think it's less likely that it's going to happen now, and I think that's probably what people feel. I think the administration didn't do a real good job of making the connection between this tax cut and the revival of the economy and job creation. I think nonsensical rantings like Warren Buffett's don't help things.
Alicia, what do you make of what Warren Buffett had to say, and what do you think people on Cape Cod are making of this tax cut? They should be dancing in the streets, right?
Well, we're more Jimmy Buffett than Warren Buffett down here, but I think the difference between Mr. Buffett and his secretary is probably playing out on Cape Cod. For the retiree, people with money population on Cape Cod, the effect on the stock market and on dividends is a big deal. But I think for the rest of the folks, the people who work in the restaurants and who teach the children and so forth, I'm not hearing that this is perceived as great news for them. And, of course, we're all just hoping that everybody takes their $400 kid kickback and vacations on Cape Cod.
It sounds like, though, Mr. Buffett should give his receptionist a raise.
And a vacation.
Yes.
Yeah, well, for the tone of his piece was very much that this is just plain unfair.
Well, the tax code's unfair, and so it's going to be hard to have a tax cut that's fair when you have the top 5% of earners in this country paying for, 40 to 50% of the cost of government? So no. The tax code itself is unfair.
And I do think more people are complaining about... I don't think if you had surveyed people a year ago, they all would have said first on their mind is to cut our taxes a little bit. I think they would have said health care costs, benefits, jobs.
Right. Now, what about local, state, and city budgets, which are all hurting? And that means trouble for schools, and that means trouble for fixing roads, and that means trouble for health care. Is this the right time? Do you think people have a sense this is the right time for a federal tax cut when there are so many local budget shortfalls?
I don't know that...
Or do people not make that calculation?
Yeah, I'm not sure that calculation is being made. And I think what you're seeing happening at the local level are a whole lot of people cutting budgets and cutting spending that went out of the control over the last decade when times were good.
Huh.
A lot of towns are hurting out here. Education is suffering, and Massachusetts is in a downspin, at least in terms of its state budget. So it is rough on towns. I also don't think people are making the connection between this tax cut and the fact that there are more kids in their child's classroom. People are worried about taxes on a local level.
But it is a good point. Right now, things are out of balance. You have way too high a percentage of the tax dollars going to the federal government. If we had a better balance, more of those tax dollars would go right from the taxpayer to the local level. You know, perhaps you'd have a better sense of fairness in this whole thing.
Alicia, do most people, when they hear tax cut, not go much deeper and just figure tax cut, that's good?
Yeah, I actually, we've been talking about this in the newsroom, that between the state budget and the federal budget and then all the town budgets, I'm not sure. I think people have just lost the thread.
Yeah.
You know, on how it works and how their school budgets are funded. And, you know, probably that's part of our role is to do a better job of explaining to folks what these individual cuts actually mean.
Nolan, what else is going on in your neck of the woods?
Well, we've got a mayor who's facing a world of controversy for his personal behavior. As you know, we've got one of the youngest mayors of a big city in the nation. He's 31 years old. He calls himself the hip-hop mayor. He wears a big diamond stud earring and wears
dandy suits.
This is Kwame Kilpatrick?
Kwame Kilpatrick. For months, rumors have been circulating around about a wild party at the mayor's residence that included strippers. And the rumor was that, the mayor's wife came in, saw a stripper on his lap, and beat the sap out of her, and then there was a big cover-up. Now, the mayor fired the Internal Affairs Bureau chief who was investigating these rumors 2 weeks ago, and that just simply opened the door for all of this to come out into the public, and everyone else is trying to sort fact from fiction.
No wonder not too many people in Detroit are trying to sort out the new tax cut.
I guess. This is too exciting. He has the largest security detail in the country, and when he goes out for a ride at night on his Harley, he takes three of them with him on city-owned Harley, so it's quite a spectacle.
Huh. A politician, strippers, Harleys. Yeah.
What more could you ask?
Alicia, let's talk just for a moment about the Cape Cod oil spill. There was an oil spill down there in Buzzards Bay. It was originally portrayed as not such a big deal. Maybe it was a bigger deal, huh?
Yeah, that's right. They originally thought they had spilled about 14,000 gallons of oil off this barge. They now are saying that they spilled more like 98,000, which, apparently it's sort of like the honor system when you spill oil. The Coast Guard, everybody asks you how much you've spilled, and you sort of...
Oh, yeah, the honor system, that always works.
Well, that certainly works with other things the Coast Guard does. Tracking down a boat with drugs, I don't imagine they would ask the guys on the boat, gee, how much have you got? Well, we got a kilo here. We'll see you later.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap it up at this point. I want to thank you both for a lively conversation right before this Memorial Day weekend, which I hope you both enjoy.
Ditto.
You too, Bill.
Thanks very much. Nolan Finley is editorial page editor of the Detroit News in Michigan. Alicia Blaisdell Bannon is managing editor of the Cape Cod Times in Hyannis, Massachusetts. You're listening to Here and Now.
Every day at Here and Now, we have our morning meeting, a civil discussion of the news to figure out which stories we'll select. This morning, my suggestion got a rousing reception.
Hey, you guys, I have an idea. How about we do a story on Annika Sorenstam?
Oh, God, it's been done.
The only thing worse than watching golf would be analyzing golf 2 days later on the radio.
I like it.
Thank you, Mitch.
Well, that went well. But maybe the rest of them have a point. Annika Sorenstam, the first woman to compete on the men's pro golf tour since Babe Didrikson-Zaharias did it in 1945, has gotten quite a lot of coverage. At Here and Now, we try to avoid the stories stuck in the media spin cycle. But I think I can make the case for mentioning this one. First of all, you should know I'm not a golfer. I'm the opposite of a golfer. When I watch the Masters, it's because the course there has great azaleas. When I was growing up, my dad and brother were both champions at Bethpage State Park, but I always thought it was a better sledding hill than a golf course, frankly. And in the days leading up to yesterday's first round, when everyone was saying how Annika would have to play the long tee with the men instead of the short tee the women play on, I was thinking, why would women need that little stick that holds up the ball to be shorter? Well, of course, I found out they were talking about the length of the fairway, because women move up about 20 yards to tee off. They generally can't hit as far as men. Whatever. That doesn't matter to me. But it does to golfers, so for the record, here's PGA golfer Phil Mickelson. She hit it longer and harder than I thought she would. She could easily compete on this level. Or Patrick Sheehan, who came into the game as a late replacement for Vijay Singh, who stayed home to take a nap rather than play with a woman. Shaheen said Sorenstam's play yesterday on the longer 7,000-plus-yard course would be the equivalent of a man adding 1,000 yards to his game. Aaron Barber, who partnered with her, said, "She's awesome. She's a machine." And a friend of mine was ecstatic. "She beat Sergio Garcia," he said. "That's great," I said. "Who's Sergio Garcia?" Well, apparently he's pretty good. And by the way, the Sorenstam story, for me anyway, is not about women's rights. I know some people are concerned about the all-male aspect of some golf clubs, and exclusion is something to keep an eye on. But it doesn't bother me if, on merit, men occupy the upper ranks of any sport. Not that I don't care about opportunities for women. I started running in Boys Tigers because they didn't make girls' running shoes. Now my niece has the chance to play lacrosse, basketball, and soccer, and that's good. But it's not about that. It's about something more than being a fan or being a feminist. It's about those moments when someone reaches beyond what everyone expects of them. It's about the word that kids are so familiar with, trying. Having the world's spotlight swing your way and snap on, and you step into the glare and you raise your game, despite the meatheads in the back of the classroom or on sports talk radio. It's about there being so few mountains left to climb, so few firsts for kids especially to see, so that when anyone, man or woman, goes against the odds, shouldn't we cheer them on? If Annika Sorenstam's stride down the fairway is ennobling for her, and it's also encouraging and uplifting for kids, for anyone, what's the harm? For the record books, Annika Sorenstam finished yesterday one over par at 71. She's tied for 73rd in a field of 114. If she makes the cut today, she goes on to the weekend. I don't know a bogey from a birdie, but I'll be cheering her on. Yeah! Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by 10,000 Villages in Brookline, hosting an Oriental Rug event now through the 31st of May, featuring fairly traded rugs made by adults in Pakistan. 10,000villages.org. David Babson and Company, investment advisors to private clients and institutions, working to help clients build and preserve wealth since 1940. David L. Babson, in Cambridge and on the web at lbabson.com. And Flora Restaurant on Mass Ave in Arlington, preparing seasonal farm-fresh cooking for dinner Tuesdays through Saturdays. Located one block from the Capitol Theater, florarestaurant.com. Come explore Italy with Silvia Poggioli on our next Citizens of the World tour this summer. Proceeds help pay for the news. For more, call 800-909-9287. 54 degrees and raining. This is WBUR.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Gambling can be a very expensive habit. Just ask William Bennett, who reportedly lost $8 million over 10 years. It can also be an obsession that will destroy you, and you can ask Marilyn Feinberg about that. Marilyn is a certified addiction specialist with a specialization in compulsive gambling. She's also our guest film reviewer this week for the new movie, Owning Mahoney. And Marilyn, in welcoming you, I suppose we've just given our first clue. Owning Mahoney is not about the casual high roller.
No, it's not, Robin. It is about a man who is a pathological gambler.
And gets into a lot of trouble. The film stars Philip Seymour Hoffman.
What are you doing here?
Well, we got a little concerned when you didn't show. We thought maybe you were sick or something.
No, you can't be here. Right? This is not the racetrack.
How much you got for his banker?
I told you, I need a day or two.
That was on Monday, Dan. This is Friday.
Look, guys, I'm having a bad run. So what? Right, just give me 5,000 more.
5,000 more?
Yes.
Well, if you can't look after yourself, I'm going to have to do it for you.
Right, what are you saying?
I'm saying that we're going to have to come up with a payment plan. Will you give me a certain amount of money on a certain day, and until you're paid up, you do not play?
You can't do that.
I can do it. I'm doing it now.
I thought we had a relationship here.
We have a relationship, and that is why I'm shutting you down.
For a few grand?
It's not a few grand, Dan. It's 10,300.
All right, so what am I supposed to do? Go to the racetrack and watch?
Owning Mahoney is based on the true story of Toronto banker Brian Maloney. In the 1980s, he managed to siphon $10.2 million from his bank to cover his ballooning gambling debts. His story was told in Gary Stephen Ross's 1984 book, Stung, The Incredible Obsession of Brian Maloney. And now it's in theaters as Owning Mahoney. And here now, film reviewer Renee Graham joins addiction specialist Marilyn Feinberg to talk about the film. Hi, Renee, to you as well.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
Good. Well, let's start with Marilyn first. You said everything you know about gambling you know from gamblers, because you're not a gambler yourself, we should say. You've worked with them over 20 years. So do you think, to start, this film offers an accurate portrayal of someone who is just addicted to it?
Yes, and I think that was the strength of the film. It really was able to portray accurately someone who really completely focused on what he was doing, There was nothing about the outside world, his relationships, the casino, anything that he would get from the casino that interested him except gambling, staying in the action.
Critics say he doesn't make contact with anyone in the film, including the camera.
He doesn't.
Yeah.
He's completely isolated.
Yeah. Well, Renee, Philip Seymour Hoffman, one of our favorite actors, he's the one who loses himself in roles such as he was the nurse in Magnolia, the whistleblower in The Insiders. How do you think he did?
He's a wonderful actor. It's hard to imagine anyone else pulling this role off. Physically, he's right. There's something schlubby about him. There's something everyman about him. He's a little shaggy. He's a little unkempt. And that works for the character. I mean, one of the running gags in the movie is how he is the youngest assistant bank manager in his bank's history, but he has lousy suits. He drives a crappy car because every cent he has goes towards gambling. To support his gambling habit, he begins stealing money from his bank. Someone will ask for a loan, and he will take out more money than the loan that was asked for so he could take the difference and use that. And it just keeps ballooning and snowballing. And it happens with this large loan he's taken care of for the Selkirk account.
Alex Reismer called about the Selkirk loan.
Oh, right.
Hmm? He's coming down to sign out the operating funds.
All right, I'll get the paperwork ready. What's the number?
They need $200,000 cash.
Hey, Dan, your cash is here. The Selkirk account, $300,000. Is it going to be collected today or not?
It'll be here in an hour.
Pardon?
An hour?
Oh, I have to wait an hour?
What, you got a hot date?
Something like that.
Something like that. Want me to sign for it?
Would you mind?
My pleasure.
Oh, great.
So, Renee, do you like the film?
I love this film. It taught me a lot about gambling addictions. I've never really understood gambling. I don't understand the allure of it at all. But there was a way that he just really portrayed the desperation. And he was gambling on everything. He gambled on horses. He would bet every baseball game in a given day. By the end of the movie, he's going to casinos and just winning and losing millions of dollars in the course of a single evening. It was fascinating.
Well, Marilyn, some of what you learned you already knew about. Tell us about some of the behavior that you know is real that you also saw in the character.
I was struck with, as Renee talked about, his kind of not even taking care of himself physically. His clothes were almost, he didn't have a coat until his girlfriend bought him a coat. And I thought the film did a very good job portraying that.
He's completely closed off from everything in his life, including his girlfriend's, played by Minnie Driver, in an absolutely ghastly blonde wig. She's a teller at the bank where he works. And you know, she wants this relationship with him. She wants him to be married and have a nice home. And he's not open to it, only because he can't see anything but gambling. He doesn't even understand it's unraveling everything in his life, including this relationship with this long-suffering woman.
That's right.
I got kind of tied up, you know. Guess you're going to be mad at me.
Well, where are you?
Just out, messing around. I'm going to make it up to you, Flynn.
Marilyn, how does owning Mahoney compare to, say, The Gambler with James Caan?
I think The Gambler with James Caan is a fabulous film. I think it's probably one of the best portrayals of a compulsive gambler in that. What it does is it gives the audience a sense of who this man is, where he came from, what his family pressures were all about, and you can start to kind of understand his psychology as a lay person. And this is something I think that didn't happen in this film. Where you met Dan was in the throes of his addiction. And that's where you met him, and that's where you really left off.
And if you're going to be an addict, you need a pusher. And in this movie, it's played by John Hurt, who plays a character named Victor Foss, who is the casino manager. And when Mahoney walks into his casino and he realizes the kind of money he has to gamble with. He's, you know, giving him the best suite. He's sending hookers to his room. He wants to give him great meals. And even he, I think, is a little surprised by how deep Mahoney is into his gambling, that even when it comes time to ask for something to eat, he doesn't want the best steak in the house. He wants, you know, a plate of ribs, no sauce, and a Coke.
Perhaps you'd prefer the Hayakita Steakhouse.
You know, barbecued ribs would be good, with no sauce and a Coke.
So, Renee, tell us more about just the movie itself. I mean, the director, Richard Kwiatkowski, I hope I have that right, has only one other film, which is Love and Death on Long Island. It also starred John Hurt. So what's the look and the feel of it? Are you sweating it out along with Hoffman?
It's a really quiet film, and he underplays his role, which I think really works, because you still get this sense of it. There aren't the kinds of bells and whistles you would think would go with a gambling film. It doesn't have this sort of, you know, loose, jazzy feel. It's what the film is about is this creeping, you know, never-ending desperation. And the way it's directed, everything's very low-key, everything's very muted. Even the colors in the casino seem somewhat muted. Mm-hmm. And I think that, again, you never get swept up in the glory of it all. And boy, wouldn't this be fun, and what a great life it is to be a gambler. It always seems very sad and joyless. That's the way it felt to me.
Well, and we're not sure people are going to be swept up in the film because it's not opened completely. It's only opened in select theaters. So what do you think, Renee? Is this going to be something that people might end up renting on tape? Or
I think it's a movie that's worth seeking out now. I mean, you know, it'll come out on DVD, but it's worth seeing now. It's the kind of movie that needs the support because, I mean, Philip Seymour Hoffman is in it, but he isn't an actor who's known to open a film. I think it's a really interesting, smart film about a subject people probably don't know a lot about.
Is it a cautionary tale, though, Marilyn? I mean, is it something, if someone thinks they have a problem, would you recommend it? Is this sort of a cautionary tale or just one man's tale?
I think it's one man's tale. I think it could be seen as a cautionary tale. I think so much of this is characterological. I think everyone gambles for very different reasons, and I think it would be curious to be able to know more about this character psychologically.
Maybe there will be a prequel. Well, thank you both.
Thank you.
Our guest reviewer this week was Marilyn Feinberg, certified addiction specialist with a specialization in compulsive gambling. She's associated with the Massachusetts Council on Compulsive Gambling. And also Renee Graham, pop culture writer associated with the Boston Globe.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Metzen, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna, and our editor is Mitch Wortley. Special thanks today to Mike McGrath, host of WHYY's You Bet Your Garden.
That's right. Thanks, Mike. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Boris Strapachki. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our interns are Lindsay Crudell and Marisa Frenchy.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
Have a great weekend and join us again Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com. MathWorks.com.